Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Bakari Sellers, I'm excited to have him join us here on the Michael Steele podcast today, folks. Welcome. Bakari made history in 2006 when, at just 22 years old, he defeated a 26-year incumbent state representative to become the youngest member of the South Carolina State Legislature and the youngest African-American elected official in the nation. In 2014, Bakari was the Democratic nominee for lieutenant governor in the state of South Carolina. And then he went on to serve, unfortunately, not in that capacity, but as a political analyst at CNN and served in the South Carolina State Legislature as well. Recently named to Time's 40 Under 40 list. He is also a practicing attorney who fights to give a voice to the voiceless. He is the author of several books, including his newest release, The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward. Now we talk about that reckoning and we talk about that forward movement right here on the Michael Steele podcast, coming up right after this. What up, everybody? Welcome to the Michael Steele podcast. Love having you join me here in the house. I'm excited about the conversation because we're going to talk with a brother whom I've grown to admire and watch and learn from. It's got some wisdom for his youthful looks there. I love it. He's looking at him trying to slide it off on the side. It's a real pleasure to welcome to the conversation, Bakari Sellers. Thanks, man, for joining up.
No, thank you, man. I've admired you for a very long period of time. Many people don't know our political careers overlapped. And so I was able to look up to you from a distance. And even more importantly, man, I appreciate you've charted your own course and you were relatable and would not allow people to pigeonhole you long before it was popular. So I appreciate that.
No, I appreciate that, man. Look, you know, I followed on in the footsteps of guys like Ron Brown and Marion Barry. Everyone always, when I mention Marion, they go, Marion. I'm like, yeah, Marion was a deep thinker of politics and very successful. And a lot of these guys looked past my party label and just told me how to be a good leader. And the most important thing was stay in your skin, you know? Yep. And I got to look
at Marion. I don't let anybody talk bad about Marion. You know, Marion and my dad were really close and sick. Yep. Uncle Marion is what I called him. I went to lunch with him many a times when he was on city council up there. And, you know, there, if you go to Washington, D.C. right now and you talk to anybody above the age of 35, they will all that are from D.C. He has a 90% approval rating.
Yep. To this day.
To this day.
Look! If they could get the brother back in the council chamber or the mayor's office today, they would. You know, that rolls.
Yeah.
Well, man, I'm really proud for you and your success. You have been in space, writing and talking about a lot of important cultural and political issues that, you know, that are impacting folks today, giving context to it. And your latest work for me, which is important because it really is how you kind of reconcile these moments. Because I don't think a lot of people, Bakari, appreciate that we are setting a pathway for the future. We're just not following the path that has been set by those who've come before us, like the gentleman we talked about, Brown, Marion Barry, George Bush on the Republican side and others. But we ourselves are writing this course. So your book, The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward Now, really talks about moving into that future, writing that future. Give us your thoughts around the book before we get into some of the particular aspects of what you've written, and particularly how you contextualize what you've written with what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, no, maybe it was my youthful naivete, but I thought in 2020 when we were in COVID and the summer was literally and figuratively hot, meaning the streets were bubbling over with George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, Breonna Taylor all happening in quick succession. You know, I felt, from studying history, that maybe we were on the precipice of a third Reconstruction.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, a moment that we missed. And not only did we miss it, I would articulate that we've regressed and gone backwards since that time. And I wanted to be able to highlight how we missed that particular time frame and how we missed that opportunity to have that growth. And with every Reconstruction we've had in this country, there has been a great correction. And when you look at those periods of time where you've had great deals of progress, or dare I say, movement towards equality, you've had these overcorrections. And I would articulate now we're starting to see that through policy, through the casual conversation on social media, through the media lens of some of our friends like Tucker and Sean Hannity and Clay
right.
Travis and
right.
Ben Shapiro. And I forget the one that ain't smart. What's the young one that's not smart? He runs the...
Oh, what's his name from...
Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk. USA. Talking Point USA, yeah.
Yeah. And so when you look and analyze just the language of that media and kind of where we are, it makes you realize, I steal from King in the afterward, in the final part of the book, that we're in the nadir, in the darkest portion of time. But that also gives you hope, because as King said, only when it's darkest can you see the stars.
Yeah, so that's true. And the concern I have are the number of people who refuse to look up.
there is a concern of that, of people who refuse to look up. I wholeheartedly agree, and I've never thought about it like that. And there are some people who are so overwhelmed in their daily task that they can't look up. And I think it's a combination of both. And when my dad would argue that we are in, and one of the things I put in the first part of the book, which jumped out more to readers than it did to me when I wrote it, and you've probably had this experience too, either you're writing something on a page,
right,
or you're giving a speech and you just write a word and then everybody, it hangs on what you just thought to be kind of in passing. But my dad argues that we're in 1954 right now. And I push back on that and kind of disagree with that. But one of the metrics that, you can look at is like Black home ownership. Black home ownership today is where it was in 1968, right? Pre-Fair
yep.
Housing Act. And so, some of those metrics would give credence to his thought. But I'm with you that there are some people who just refuse to look up. But there are also some people who are just inundated with the day.
But Kari, your dad and I are probably generationally very close.
He was born in 44. He might be, he's older than you.
Oh, he's older. Okay. Gotcha. So yeah, he's about 10 years. I'm 58. So, but even in that span, I get what he's saying. And I would agree. The whole Make America Greater thing is harkening back to 1954.
Mm-hmm.
It's white picket fences, mom at home with the apron waiting for dad to come in, two kids out there, picket fence, all of that. And that, as I point out to a lot of folks, that America really didn't exist. That was kind of a fictionalized America that Hollywood gave us.
Correct.
Make room for daddy and leave it to Beaver and all of that crazy, daddy knows best or whatever. So there is a little bit of truth to this idea that we're in a period where people are trying to reimagine America, an America that never really existed.
Yeah.
Right. And this idea that for me that they won't, and I really appreciate the way you're putting it, we're in the dark spot, but we're getting the light from the stars. That's the hope. That's where we're going. But if you're not looking up to see that hope, it becomes harder to move through the moment, because that's where leadership comes in. That's where voices like yours and mine even though we may be on opposite sides of the political pole in terms of where America is standing and needs right. to stand, we are together. And that becomes a different conversation.
Yeah, it does. And it also to bring it out to a more 50,000 foot view, it makes me think about usually the only time I put Donald Trump and Joe Biden in the same sentence when you talk about leadership is that these two men who are our choices for respective choices for president of the United States have one unique similarity, which is detrimental to the future of this country. And that is that they both live in the past. They do it for different reasons, but they right. both live in the past. Donald Trump is more of a vessel for grievance. Joe Biden has this weird nostalgia for yesteryear. He grips right. onto Pop Pop and all of these stories.
Right.
My uncle got eaten by cannibals and wherever. Right. and so it's a weird thing. And what that means is that we're not seeing a vision for the future, which I think, and I think you would agree, is necessary if you're going to have some leadership. Now, I don't know if it's being captive of age. I said this the other day and I thought about it. I'm not being ageist. I don't know if there is a such thing as an 83-year-old visionary, but right. he's going to have to be the first if there hasn't been one, because he needs to be able to articulate what the vision for my 5-year-old twins will be for the future, even if he's not going to be here. That's looking up at the stars. That is what a leader should be able to do.
Well, and there I agree with you. And I've always looked at Biden. I stated this in the 2020 cycle, well before, we got to the point of, the campaigns that, and he got in the campaign. I said, at that time, if Joe Biden gets in the campaign, Joe Biden can only serve as a transitional figure. He can only be that bridge between what we've just gone through in the last 4 years, setting up an authoritarian sort of illiberal narrative, and what America will be for your 5-year-old, and not that he has to be the person who gives us the vision, he has to be the person that reminds us of the importance of the country, so that vision can survive long enough for you and your generation to take the baton and move the country for your 5-year-old and all the other 5-year-olds out there. That was an anticipation that, we get through 20 to 24, that pattern will be set. No one accounted for, and I don't know why, Donald Trump getting back in the game again, and on the Republican side, but more on the Democratic side, leveling up that visionary who could then make that case from 24 yeah. going forward.
And I think the reemergence, reemergence may not be the right word, but the recentering of Donald Trump being that figure of opposition did nothing but embolden Anita Dunn and General
right.
Mallory Griffin and
right.
And Valerie Biden Owens, and then by virtue the President of the United States to say, I'm the only one who can beat him. And it's kind of I don't know if that's not a fact. It appears right now to be objectively true, but it also gives the hint of being drunk off power a little bit. And now you reset this matchup, which is probably the second most unpopular matchup in the history of the country, only behind Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, yeah. And we're forced in a binary system to make a binary choice. And people, in my view, don't fully appreciate the fact that if you don't participate in that system, that choice will be made for you one way or the other.
Choice is always made for you, but I don't think it's binary, actually. And that's one of the things that we're kind of talking about. I actually think that this race is between Joe Biden, Donald Trump, and the couch. And I think we're starting to see the couch.
Fair point.
The couch is one of the most amazing, fascinating candidates ever. Don't run no ad, but every year get more popular. And Joe Biden's biggest competition ain't really Donald Trump. Joe Biden's biggest competition is people choosing the couch. And, right. Like places like Detroit, Michigan, if black men decide to, I don't really want to do this, right. My life didn't change much under either one of them. I'm going to go to work today.
Right.
That, in Philadelphia, Donald Trump is reelected.
Yeah, no, that's true. This message brought to you by the couch. No,
exactly.
That's exactly right. So what are the things that I thought was important, and sort of setting the tone of your book and the direction of the moment, was the conversation that you raised up around George Floyd, and you talk about you're grappling with that on CNN, and just sort of sharing not just how devastated you were by what we saw happening in May of 2020, but then ultimately what it boiled down to. And I took from it, because I felt the same way, and really it says a lot that we represent two different generations, but we are at the exact same point in May of 2020, and that is, it's hard being Black in this country when your life is not valued and people are worried about the protesters and the looters, and it's just people who are frustrated for far too long and have not had their voices heard. It has struck me, and I thought when I read that passage, I thought of two things. One was January 6th, and the other was what we see happening right now on some of our college campuses around the Palestinian situation. And I thought, wow, especially with January 6th, if Black folks had decided to behave the way aggrieved white folks did on that day, how different the response would have been, how negative the response would have been to the voices of Black people about yet another killing, indiscriminate killing of a Black man in a traffic stop, or walking the streets, or buying a candy bar. And I still think that's lost on a lot of folks, man. I still don't think they get the nexus. I
No,
really don't.
they don't, and that's what I was attempting to articulate that morning, and it was difficult because I was on after Felonious Floyd and Ben Crump, and I was able to hear the pain in Felonious's voice, and my kids were asleep in the house and trying to be, as millennials we are now parents, right? So it's fascinating to see us trying to raise children in this world, something that your generation has achieved and laid out for us in a way that we can only hope and wish that we can lay out for our children. I have a point about that too, that I'll come back to. But it's you're right about the nexus, and Dr. King would always talk about rioting and protesting, and he would always articulate it as being, the kind of the voices of the unheard. And when people go unheard for so long, this is the manifestation thereof. And in this country, we kind of have this kind of Black death porn that we have been, people just kind of just gravitate toward it and want to see it. And George Floyd was so unique, because I'll also say that it would not have been George Floyd or as big as that if we weren't in COVID, because you couldn't turn your heads away. You couldn't go to work. You couldn't go outside. You were stuck inside and had to watch that over and over and over again. And it took a lot. I mean, you think about the fact it took Donella Frazier, who was a 17-year-old Black woman, having her camera out, took the video of a Black man with a knee on the back of his neck screaming out for his mama for 9 minutes. You took the fact we were in COVID, and it took all of those things just to have accountability. If one of those things isn't there, we don't get Derek Chauvin going to trial, and we don't get Derek Chauvin, because I represent these families all the time, and this level of justice and accountability is something that's fleeting, to say the least. And lastly, in my analysis, you mentioned something. January 6th in Charlottesville were so fascinating to me, and they weren't fascinating to me because of the anti-Semitism or the racism. I mean, I think you and I are probably, being Black men of a certain age, I don't want to say desensitized, but when somebody says, "Oh, there's racism going on over there," we're not like, "Oh my God," and clutch
No.
our But for me,
Yeah, exactly.
the most fascinating part was that they didn't wear hoods, like they didn't cover their faces.
No.
That just shows you where we are. January 6th, Charlottesville, these people are out there chanting the most vile things. They are running through the Capitol with the Confederate flag. They're stealing Nancy Pelosi's like laptops and lecterns and One dude even showed up at January 6th with his work lanyard on. I was, it's this level of being unashamed that really, really, really disturbed me and said that we're in a troubling part in our country when people are espousing this, doing this, and they're not afraid to cover their faces any longer.
And they're not a, so they're not afraid because they feel that there's some protection from the system. I mean, when you think about the fact that Donald Trump would tell his folks in his rally, if you smack the crap out of someone who's disagreeing with what I'm saying here, because they, someone would protest. You've been to rally, someone say something and someone, oh, I don't know, right? But I'll pay your legal fees. Don't worry about it. I got you covered, right? When he tells them, I'm going to be your retribution, I'm going to, pay back. They're coming after me. They're not coming after you. So if I know that someone else is going to absorb a lot of the incoming, then I'm much more inclined to want to move forward. I'm not afraid to keep my work lanyard on. The hood, I don't need the hood anymore because I now have permission structures that have been put in place that will allow me to fervently go out and use the N-word. We saw that on Twitter when that permission structure was created. We've seen it at the rallies where folks aren't afraid to use white nationalism, Christian nationalism to embrace Nazism and other evils. So yeah, I give you the permission structure. You do anything you want.
I mean, that just shows you. I mean, what Donald Trump has been more than anything else is a conduit for white grievance. And there are a lot of people that see themselves in him, which, by the way, to me, in history will go down as one of the greatest cons in the, it
P.T.
is
Barnum got nothing on what
nothing.
this man can do.
And this man uses the bathroom on gold toilets or gold-plated toilets.
Right.
And he has convinced poor people in Mississippi that he speaks for them. And it is, it's a weird. But they also see that he goes without accountability. They also
That's
see that
it.
he goes without any repercussion, or the boomerang never comes back. And so they see themselves in him. And so they're like, if this man's speaking for me, maybe I need to speak up and join his militia. And then I don't have to worry about any retribution as well, because we are now telling our version of our truth as we see it.
Right. So you in this book, you in the second chapter, you it's a letter to your young son. What were you trying to convey there?
In my first book, My Vanishing Country, it really was an ode to Black women. I talked about my daughter a lot in that book because of everything that she'd overcome with the liver transplant and all of those things. And it was just
Right.
life. And now the blinking lights have been on for me with Black men and Black boys for a long period of time. And just, we have not fully examined the causes behind the erosions that we see in the community fabric when it comes to Black men. And also, people for some reason forget that the second largest demographic voting for Democrats behind Black women is Black men. Like, you just,
Right.
like, it's just a conversation that's not had much. And for the chapter about my son in particular, I just wanted to have a conversation, man-to-man conversation. I wanted people to see what that looks like. I wanted people to see that love. I wanted people to be able to read that upliftment, see that history. And then maybe when Stokely's old enough, I will really want a response from him. I would like a response from him when he's 8. I would like a response from him when he's in college. I would like a response from him when he starts a family, and kind
Right.
of what his response is to, my charge about just trying to fulfill the legacy of your grandparents and great grandparents, and also stand in the gap for your brothers who may not have that infrastructure in place that you have.
So what do you tell him when he's 16, 17 and hanging out with his friends? And they're driving somewhere, they're at a party somewhere, and police are involved. What do you tell
I mean, first of all, I don't know. Because he's five now, they're five now, but I
Right.
think if the environment was what it is today, you know, if they're driving somewhere, I would probably give them the same lessons my father told me, which is to turn down your music first, drive, call 911, which is what, and the reason we do that, people find that to be strange, but I'm from South Carolina, and a
Yep.
lot of these roads are dark. A lot of these roads are two-lane highways.
Yep.
Call 911 and you let them know that you're going to somewhere with light so they won't think that you're running away from them. You pull into somewhere with light and then you recognize that you don't have to fight this battle on the side of the road. We can we have the resources to be able to fight these battles in the court of law.
Right.
And so, you know, your goal is you go into survival mode. You want to come home. And I want to make sure that Stokely does everything he should do to not make his mama angry or break her heart.
Right. So that's part of the racial injustice that he has to do that. And you have to do that. And you have to have that conversation. And I had it with my boys. My mother and father had it with me. And their families had it with them. And it's been part, and it's something I try to get my white friends to understand is this has become such a natural part of the conversation and growing up. Your mama and daddy talk to you about going out, hanging with your friends, and getting networked and all of that. That conversation doesn't involve, well, when you're at a party and the police are called, or you're driving home at night and you get pulled over. It's and I've had to have that conversation with my nephews and young men that I'm mentoring today, just as I had to have with my kids 20 years ago when they were in their early teens. So it really kind of begs the question, how do we get past this? I mean, what is it, what is in the moment that has to be created that will get our institutions, largely in criminal justice, police, et cetera, and more broadly in our communities, to appreciate that we've been your neighbor for 400 years. We've been building the same communities that you're living in for 400 years. So why do we continue to do this?
You know, the tragedy in that statement is that I articulate in this book that my generation, millennials, may be the first generation of parents that do not leave this country better than the one that you all gave us. And that's a very, very, very tough pill to swallow. That, for me, as a parent, is a difficult realization. That doesn't mean that I'm going to stop fighting today and be resigned. That, but hell, the trajectory we're on right now, objectively speaking, shows that, you know, that may be borne out to be true. But you're talking about these cycles, man. You're talking about these systems that we have not been able yet to deconstruct and reimagine. Because I don't think the systems are broken. I don't think the criminal justice system is broken or our healthcare delivery system is broken. I think that engineers design a system and they work as intended.
There you go. There you go. Now we're swimming in the same direction. Not that we weren't, but that's exactly where what people fundamentally need to understand first.
Yeah. And so, you know, you have to be willing to. That's why I ascribe. That's why I love Marion and I love Julian. I love these thinkers that we're talking about because they were willing to work within the system and say, wait a minute. You know, Marion was like, wait a minute. You got all these black kids around here doing a summer with ain't nothing to do. And, you know, they expecting them to be locked up. So what am I going to do? I'm going to start a youth employment, a youth jobs program in
That's
DC,
it.
change
That's
the
it.
fabric, which created, you know, help create a burgeoning middle class and taught them a skill. So when they actually graduated high school or college, they can get government contracts. I mean, it all fed into each other. It was about getting within these systems and deconstructing them and reimagining them so they look like the rest of us. And we have failed at doing that. That is the analysis. There have not been enough. There have not been enough individuals who have been willing to do that with any level of success.
Well, I will take a little bit of exception to one thing you just said about the handoff from our generation, my generation, to your generation. I think we failed you. I think you feel that way because while we may have created institutions that allow for economic prosperity and better education and all those things, we selfishly ignored some of the rot that still existed in some of those institutions as we expanded them, as we, you know, tried to make them affordable to you, if you will. Mm-hmm. And we failed in our leadership ultimately, I think, in this moment, when we suddenly became poor examples of the very thing that we told you was the light, that star, right? Mm-hmm. I think as Republicans, we failed to live up to the qualities required to keep the lights on in that shining city that Reagan talked about. And I think as Democrats, we failed to honor our social commitment that Lyndon Johnson tried to put in place with the Great Society policies, recognizing the poor, that the young will become old and potentially poor, and that there is no pathway for the poor to advance into the middle class. Even Nixon saw that, which is why, you know, he charged his Commerce Department with, under the leadership of an African-American man named Art Fletcher, to create affirmative action so that we could, you know, reimagine these structures that still had infused within them Jim Crow thinking and approaches. So we have failed, in my view, in passing on to the millennial generation, who are now the adults in the room, right? We're the seniors now. We're our numbers are shrinking. A lot of us are moving out of leadership and power, and you're moving into it.
Not enough of y'all. Not enough of y'all are moving out of leadership.
Well, that's true too. Some of us don't get the hint. but I think that we have shortchanged your ability a little bit to do what you want to do and provide what you want to provide for your 5-year old. Yeah. And that's something that I've been trying to get a lot of our folks that I talk to in my generation, because I'm at the end of the baby boomers and we've always been a transitional generation. And I look at what have we transitioned into? What have we passed on? What are we passing on? And I think we've fallen a little bit short, because while yes, capitalism, wealth, community, education, all that, but then there were some pieces that we just left untouched. So we're going to take.
Go ahead. Let me ask a question real quick. So what, you know, I have confidence in certain portions of the Democratic Party. Like I think Akeem Jeffries is going to be a great speaker. I think he's going to represent so much. It will be unfair to compare him to Nancy Pelosi, but you know, he will be
right.
Great speaker. And I think that, you know, post Biden, we will be able to have a knockdown, drag out Royal Rumble and refaction leadership in the Democratic Party. What's next for the Republican Party after Donald Trump?
This part is the party of MAGA. The fight internally will be, and you use the right word with respect to Democrats, because you will have a factional fight inside your party. And it's largely going to be a progressives versus traditional Democrats. It's not DLC Democrats that Clinton put in place. It's not that. It's traditional rock rib Democrats that are still members of your party, just like we have traditional rock rib Republicans like myself and my party that are going to come to have a come to Jesus moment with the emerging extremes on both ends. It is the cancer is metastasized inside the GOP. Our political structures, the RNC, state parties, all of that are largely 75% to 80% MAGA. Trump could be called to glory tomorrow. And not only would that fight ensue, but you would see how and why that fight would materialize because of how a lot of what Trump has already tried to do has become institutionalized inside the party. So I think you're going to see for a while those elements. And what'll happen is they'll be dressed up in better suits than Trump. They won't sit on gold. They won't sit on gold-plated toilets. You know, they'll sound a lot like Josh Hawley and Ron DeSantis, but they'll behave and they will respond to Marjorie Taylor Greene. The political behavior will be aligned with that because that portion will still be. I mean, today, just today, as we're talking, and even in the face of Hakeem Jeffries saying that Democrats will stand to protect the current Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, not because they like Mike Johnson, and not because, you know, there's some great loyalty there. It's because we got business to
We
do,
got
and
stuff to do.
you're right. And the
Stuff
country can't afford to watch Republicans show their ass for another 3 weeks trying to find another speaker. That's why. But that's not what we're going to hear. What we're going to hear is what she said today, which, you know, we're bringing this fight, we're doing this fight. It's all about fighting. This form of the party is nothing more but a second-rate fighter. That's all they do. You give them power, you give them authority to actually govern, they can't do it. But they're much better throwing bombs and cussing people out. That's where we are. And the hope is that Democrats don't fall into that trap.
I would think that, you know, one of the unique parts about it, and one of the things yet to be seen, is if anybody can harness the Trump energy at the voting booth, because we've seen year after year that they just don't show up for people who are Trump light, who and they're going to be people who try to thread a needle and be part Trump and part evangelical, which ain't really possible.
Doesn't work. Sorry.
You know, we'll just see what happens. You know, we have a lot of talented people. I'm interested to see where they land.
I am too. And I definitely have my eye on it, and I'm doing everything I can to create that factional fight inside the GOP because I want to have it. So the book is The Moment, Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We All Can Move Forward Together. I want to take a quick break. I want to come back. I want to end up with a little conversation on politics in the moment with this brother, Bakari Sellers. We'll be right back right after this.
Facepalm America is a show for progressives and others on the left who want to keep up with the ridiculousness that this country dishes out, find out what cable news misses when they're waiting for Trump to appear at a podium, and also, every once in a while, get a laugh at how silly this hot mess of a nation of ours really is. If that's you, listen to Facepalm America. You can go to facepalmamerica.com or find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Michael Steele podcast. We're in conversation with the author of The Moment. He is Bakari Sellers. His work touches on some really, really important buttons, I think, in terms of the power of Black men. You have a chapter in your book on the untapped power of Black men. Before I get into a little bit of politics, let's talk a little bit about that, because I appreciate the little bit of shout out I got in the book, where you say, I don't want to take away from traditional conservative values and moral ethos of people like Tim Scott, Sir Michael Singleton, Michael Steele, who for all intents and purposes believe that conservative values best prop up and move forward Black and brown folk. There's been a lot of noise made around Black men and Donald Trump, and the fear that seems to be emerging among some of traditional Democrats is that there's not enough attention being paid in that space. You touched on, alluded to some of that in our last segment that we were talking about, you know, a lot of focus being placed on Black women voting, but the second largest turnout is Black men.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what you see happening in that space, this allure that Donald Trump has with, and I'll put it this way, certain Black men, because he got me a little, the only thing I'm attracted to is how I beat him. That's the only thing I'm attracted to. But what do you see? Is it the LeMay painted gold sneakers and the,
I don't think it's 25% or 20% like people are saying. I think it's enough around the edges to cause concern. But I also think that the warning signs are there. We're like, the check engine light is on when it comes to Black men.
Right.
You be willing to Listen, meet them where they are. And I give you the best example. I was asked, what are three things you want to hear from Joe Biden when he goes to Morehouse, my alma mater? I said, well, the first thing is the world seems to be on fire. I want to hear, maybe not in depth specifics, but I want to hear globally about what peace looks like, right? Second thing is, one of the biggest fights we have is reproductive rights. There's a role for men to play, particularly black men to play. You talk about head of household, you talk about, God endowing everybody with free will. It's kind of this religious ethos that a lot of black men ascribe to. That's number two. Number three, an agenda that includes, Voting Rights Act and those type things. And then I said, look, he don't have to cover none of them. But if he goes up there and talks about criminal justice reform for 25 minutes, I will riot myself. Right? No,
At the front of the line? What's he
keep
doing?
him off the stage. Keep him off the stage. It's fascinating how narrow they view the black male thought
On the
to
right and the left, people, listen to what the brother's saying now.
It's like we want to know how to grow our small businesses. We want to make sure that we are playing a role in the health care of our wives. We want to know about educating our young people. I mean, it's really unique to see the narrow-mindedness by which black men throughout the political process, regardless, let me tell you something. Racist whites on the right are equally as bad as this as white progressive liberals on the left. And it's where it's that unique thing where the world, the
Come
next
together,
it comes together.
doesn't it?
And so,
I call them the Bernie Sanders Donald Trump voter.
oh, that, yeah,
That
that exists. That exists. That totally.
exists.
So I don't know. I don't think black men are going to vote for Trump in these large numbers. Now there is an allure of Donald Trump with his strength that he, I think it's a false sense of bravado, but he comes and he says what he wants to say and how he wants to say it, and he's decently misogynistic and all of these things. I think there's a level of bravado that woos some individuals, but I just think that's a small number of people.
Yeah, it is. It is a small number of people, but I think that at the end of the day, it's a false narrative because Donald Trump is a punk, in my view. I've said it publicly, and I'll continue to say it throughout this
I would agree.
campaign.
I would agree. I would
He
agree.
is that bully on the playground that the one te one the one time the small kid that he picks on actually knees him in the nuts. That's it. It's over,
He never,
right?
Mike Tyson said it best, and this is very figurative. I don't need the Secret Service, knocking at my door. But everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, right?
That's it.
That is, and
That's it.
it's figuratively, it's really weird to see when, and that's why he also picks on a lot of women. That's why he also picks on a lot of black women. But it's fascinating to see when somebody is able to go to toe to toe with Donald Trump, he cowers.
Be
He really.
cowards. What's the state of the black church in all of this?
I write it.
I loved
Yeah.
what you were writing on that.
Yeah, no, I overgeneralize purposefully. I utilize the words black church a lot. And a lot of people are going to say, well, my church does this
I
and
know,
does
and they get defensive real quick, don't
real
they?
quick, real quick. But you are a little younger than my dad, but you still were on the tail end of what the church used to be. How it wasn't a Sunday morning place for
That's
worship. It
right.
was Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday place where you organized, mobilized, where you fed people who needed to be fed, where you sheltered people who needed to be sheltered, where you could congregate and meet. And I would argue that prosperity gospel has creeped its ugly head into the church and replaced. I don't mind prosperity gospel and, but we've seen a lot of prosperity gospel to the exclusion of other ministries, which we need in our communities.
No, I could not agree with you more because it goes to the heart. Well, it actually goes to the heart of everything else we've talked about. It goes to the heart of how black men are positioned in the family. It goes to the heart of how black women are allowed to their fullest expression. It goes to the heart of how young black boys and girls grow up to be successful, prosperous, and committed American citizens. So, and the church has always played a fundamental role in all of that. And that, I think, is an important aspect of all of this. Look, dude, I know there's a thousand and one things I
I
want to
like
talk to
talking
you.
to you. We got to do, we might need to take this on the road and do this offline.
I think we need to have a conversation about how you and I can broaden this because This book, and again, folks, is called The Moment: Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward Now. Just really opened up a lot of stuff, a lot of stuff that I said as a young man in your shoes at the time. And it's really kind of weird to read stuff that you're writing today that I was feeling and thinking 30 years ago. And I think it's worth the conversation we need to have. I just do. I just thoroughly enjoyed this. I know you're on a schedule. I don't want to hold you up, but I thank you for coming by and sharing some insights with my crew. And I would like to offer for you to come back so we can continue this conversation, particularly as once we get a better sense of where this election is going to land and the role. I think Joe Biden is the next president of the United States because Black people want him to be.
Yep, I agree. Why don't we do this? Let's plan on me and you just doing one at the RNC and one at the DNC, and we'll make it a fun event.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now I'm going to have to call ahead at the RNC because I think they have to take the picture with the dart holes in it out down. So that, but, you know, we can do that.
All right, brother.
They don't welcome me as warmly, particularly now they've installed Laura Trump, his daughter-in-law there. Yeah. As a number two, but she's really the number one. Sorry, Mike Watley. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but you are not the chairman of the RNCs, but she is. Anyway, Bakari Sellers, the book is The Moment: Thoughts on the Race Reckoning That Wasn't and How We Can All Move Forward Now. Get a copy of it, read it, digest it, study it, and learn from some of the messaging there, man. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, man. Have a blessed day.
You too now. All right, folks, that does it for our time together. Peace out to all of you. Summer's almost here. We're going to have some fun because it's campaign season. Stay tuned to all that we do here. Be blessed. Be well. Take care.
Is it just me, or have we all lost our minds? It's a question more and more people are asking themselves, afraid to admit they already know the answer. It's also a podcast, one about people coming together in a time of division and uncertainty to talk about culture and politics, compromise and connections. It's about challenging the norms we've come to accept as a society and working together to find common ground. Fierce and Unfiltered, host Jennifer Horn is a former Republican strategist and party leader turned independent sanity activist. One way or another, we've all lost our minds. Join Jennifer Horn in the search to find them again.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.